This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. North Carolina is known around the country as a producer of tobacco, textiles, furniture, and great men's college basketball. But only one of those exports is really flourishing right now. The Atlantic Coast Conference celebrated its 50th anniversary a year ago, and this season it has added two teams, Miami and Virginia Tech, in an expansion that has been somewhat controversial. Next season, Boston College will enter the ACC Conference, giving the ACC 12 teams that spread from South Florida to New England. Now, the reason for this expansion is another college sport, football, and the financial windfall that three new teams bring will be measured in the tens of millions of dollars. But the ACC is, at its heart, a basketball conference. At the start of this season, three of the top-ranked five teams in the country are from the ACC. Is the heart of the ACC basketball being torn out for financial reasons? And how is it a better league if traditional North Carolina rivalries are being sacrificed, as they may, with the expansion? We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-888-472-3366. That's 1-888-472-3366. With us to talk about all of this is Lennox Rawlings, who is a sports columnist with the Winston-Salem Journal, and Mick Mixon, a color analyst with the Tar Heel Sports Network. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
It's good to be on with you, Melinda, and also with Lennox, who I just want to say right off, I always had a lot of respect for. He's really good with words, and he thinks and writes on a little higher plane, so I'm looking forward to the hour and learning something, as well as hopefully talking about a few things today.
Very cool. Well, Miami and Virginia Tech were not added to the ACC expansion for what they would add to ACC basketball, of course. It was what they brought for football and the money that football games would bring. Football season is in its last few weeks, so I'd like to have us assess, how is the addition of the two programs working out in this first year of the football competition? Lennox?
I think less well than the ACC imagined. Miami was a contender for the national championship until 2 weeks ago, but is no longer. And Virginia Tech has played better recently than it did early. But I think what has happened is, in the transfer from the Big East to the ACC, these two schools have to play good teams on a consistent basis, as opposed to playing one or two tough games a year and then playing Rutgers and Temple and schools like that on the other week. So I think it's been more than they imagined in terms of getting ready for each game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mick Mixon?
I'm trying to get used to it. I'm sort of entering the curmudgeonly old man stage of my life, where I'm right on the cusp of that, where I really don't like change. And this was hard for me this summer. Just speaking personally, most sportscasters and sports writers, when something like this happens, the first filter we run it through is, how is this going to affect us? What additional snowy climbs are we going to have to go to? How many more expense reports are we going to have to fill out? What new teams are we going to have to assimilate into our bank of whatever facts and figures bounce around in our heads? But I'm trying to give it a chance, and you know, I think it should work out okay. But I do think Lennox makes a good point. Miami and the Virginia Tech did not come into the league at a great time for them. I really think Carolina beat Miami twice. I don't think Miami would have lost to Clemson had they not stumped their toe against the Tar Heels. And it's going to be an adjustment, because in the big picture, Virginia Tech and Miami have a little bit different football DNA than I think a lot of the schools in the ACC do. So it'll be interesting to see how the other schools adjust to these two new bullies on the block.
Well, we should point out that you may be going to a more northern climb when Boston College joins.
Yeah, where is that? I've heard it's...
It's very cold winters in Boston. Very cold. Sorry for that. But the whole gamble on joining the ACC for the football was, you're going to get a lot of money from them getting into these big bowl games. But it's all predicated on that, isn't it?
Well, the system is rigged, so they'll get the money anyway. It's just a matter of how much they'll get. But the system is rigged for the six largest conferences to control the bowl money.
So it's a no-risk gamble then?
So as in that, from that standpoint, the money comes from the TV contracts that you generate outside of those bowl games. Occasionally, if you got two teams in the very highest level of bowls, then you would reap a windfall of about $5 million, mm-hmm. In addition to what you would normally get. But the real money is in the TV contracts. And if you've noticed this year, virtually every game is televised on some network, and someone's paying a lot of money for that. And so that's where the big money is in the football deal. And as long as they can control the bowls like this, and keep, the NCAA makes about 90% of its money on the basketball tournament and the TV contract with CBS and ESPN, and makes very little on football. And it's basically a trade-off where the NCAA gives football to these conferences and these power schools and says, you run it however you want to.
Why is it?
It's just, well, it, you know, it flows from the history of things. It's not a conspiracy that was dreamed up last week, but it's how it's evolved. And it's a neat balancing act in which the big schools can control the flow of football, and the NCAA takes the money out of basketball and runs its operations from that.
But did the ACC have to expand? I mean, Florida State and Clemson and Georgia Tech were known to favor expansion for football reasons. So would they – do you believe, Lennox, or do you give any credibility to the theory that had John Swofford not done this, that those three schools might have led an effort to maybe join the SEC, for example, and form a 16-team super conference that would have been predatory to the ACC?
Yeah, I heard some talk of that, but I never put much credence in that because I don't see Clemson leaving for that reason. I don't see Georgia Tech leaving. Georgia Tech at one time belonged to the SEC and removed itself because of the disparity in academics and admission standards and some other issues years and years ago. So I even though they lobbied for that, I think Florida State was the only one that that you would say had any credible reason to do so. And I don't think they would have because everything fit together so well in the ACC. The real impetus for it became it's almost a shell game in which you're selling the concept that the peanut was under the shell that had yet to be uncovered. And that was if you could get 12 teams together, the NCAA would allow you to have this conference playoff game, which is worth $7, $8, $10 million, and you would lock up the East Coast, you would decimate the Big East, and you would have all this power within the structure of athletics. I think a lot of it was done to grease the egos of the people involved because they have more power now. The money runs through the accounting department, and the major players at all these schools are getting paid a lot of money anyway. And the rest of it goes to finance however many sports they have.
But there's nothing to guarantee that somebody else won't come poaching in a few years and take some teams away from this, what's going to be a 12-team conference.
That's a good
possible
point.
But the candidates to do that have now been diminished, I think. It's a small field now.
Yeah, and there's some trust involved in that. You try to make the people who are in your family happy in hopes that they'll be loyal to you and won't go look for another family. But, you know, I think the league did take a sportsmanship hit. I think the ACC always stood for something. Maybe I'm naive in my thinking, but I grew up in North Carolina, and the ACC always meant something to me that was very special as a young man and as a boy and as an adolescent and as an adult. And it did seem as though the ACC jumped first. And the ACC was the one that sort of took the first bite and said, okay, we're going to raid the Big East for these teams. I mean, it's worked out well now, but it seems as though that one summer, it was much more contentious, I think, than John Swofford anticipated.
We are talking about ACC basketball. The basketball season begins in earnest next week, and this, of course, is the season after which the ACC has expanded now to 11 teams. With us are Mick Mixon, who's a color analyst with the Tar Heel Sports Network, and Lennox Rawlings, sports columnist with the Winston-Salem Journal. We welcome your calls. Our number is 1-888-472-3366. Well, one of the ways that this expansion is affecting basketball is that the ACC has always played what's called a round-robin schedule. Each team has a home and away game against other teams in the league. And because you had to accommodate more teams in the league, there aren't enough games to go around. There aren't 22 games to have in the league. So you're going to have some games, such as North Carolina is only going to play Wake Forest once. Duke and NC State are only going to play once. Wake Forest's coach, Skip Prosser, calls this the collateral damage of expansion. And I wonder, Mick Mixon, does this get it sucking out some of the charm of ACC basketball?
I think it does. I think that there's no way to really sugarcoat that. One of the neat things about the conference, I thought, was how collegial it was. you know, and it may still be, but I think a lot, some of this is yet to be seen. But, I mean, you knew, no matter what school you're a fan of, I mean, if you're a Wake Forest fan, you knew that if you went to Maryland and you got dipped in early January, I mean, they're coming to your place in late February, and you knew you were going to get a chance to see that team again, and then maybe even meet again in the ACC tournament. And so, I mean, I'm just as a fan standpoint, I'm sad that some of that is going away.
Well, some players may be happy they don't have to go to Cameron to play Duke, but Lennox Rawlings?
Well, I read that Julius Hodge said that he's quite unhappy about that, NC State's
really?
Star in
just
the
because
ACC
of the challenge
player
of it?
The year. Yeah. Because that's part of the culture of the ACC is to go to Cameron and play. And I've heard several players in recent years who've walked away from there and had never won a game there, lost all four trips, and they regretted that they wouldn't have a chance to go back and try again. I think the greatest impact is it eliminates the legitimacy of finishing first, because no matter what happens, there'll be arguments. It'll be like the 2000 election over yep. who voted and who didn't vote.
Because if the person that comes in first had played their game at home and didn't get a chance
correct.
To go
and who had
away.
Played home and who hadn't, and these schedules are not balanced in any way. Duke has to play Maryland and Carolina as its two primary teams every year, no matter what, for television reasons. And those are tough games, whereas other teams will play Virginia Tech twice, and those, at this point, do not shape up to be tough games.
So I wonder if we're right at the point of the asterisk on the scores saying, okay, this was pre-expansion and post-expansion for when you see who's in first place. We're talking with Lennox Rawlings from the Winston-Salem Journal, Mick Mixon of the Tar Heel Sports Network. We're talking about ACC basketball. The season begins Monday. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 1-888-472-3366. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Basketball season is upon us, and here in North Carolina, that means the ACC. Wake Forest tips off the season this Monday when the Demon Deacons will play George Washington in the preseason NIT. With us in the studio to talk about ACC basketball are Lennox Rawlings, sports columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Mick Mixon, who is color analyst for the Tar Heel Sports Network. If you want to join our conversation, 1-888-472-3366 is the number. With us right now is Carrie, who's in Chapel Hill. Hi there, Carrie.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. My name is Carrie, and I'm the co-captain of the UNC field hockey team. And I just wanted to remind you all and viewers out there that while basketball season is underway, field hockey season is just wrapping up. And the top in the top five, we just had our ACC conference, and UNC was the champions.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And top four teams in that top four were all ACC teams. And so I just wanted to say that, as well as the fact that the first round of the NCAA tournament is being hosted here in Chapel Hill, and two ACC teams, UNC and Duke, will be in that bracket. So hopefully we'll get some supporters out there as the field hockey season ends up finishing and we head into basketball season.
Well, congratulations on the ACC championship there. You know, there's a question with the expansion that comes up, and that is that
right.
teams that are not the high-profile teams like football and basketball,
right.
like, say, women's field hockey, that now you're going to be in a league that stretches from next year from Boston College down to Miami.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you get put on planes to go to the games, or are you having to take a bus?
Sometimes we fly. In the event of any NCAA tournament, we would fly. But in the regular season, we would usually take a bus. For field hockey, Boston College is the only team that's really going to be added because that's the only new team that has a field hockey team. So they'll probably drive up there next year.
So how does that strike you? Is that a plus to have Boston College there? Is it worth making the drive to have the league so expanded?
Yeah, I think it's great. You know, part of the really neat thing about being a student-athlete is getting to travel around and see different parts of the country and play in different parts of the country. And though it will be a long bus ride, I think the players will appreciate it in the end, and bringing BC to the league. I think it can only be a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. Mick Mixon.
The voice of Kerry Fetting Smith, who is an outstanding field hockey player. And it is interesting. Five ACC teams play field hockey.
Yeah.
Virginia, Wake Forest, Maryland, Duke, and UNC. And Kerry's right. With the exception of Virginia, the top four teams in the nation are the ACC schools. So we should really be talking about the ACC, not as a basketball conference or as a football conference or even as a good all-around conference, but as a field hockey conference. This is a very interesting sport. Thousands of years before the first Olympics in 776 BC, the Persians, the Greeks played the sport really similar to the modern field hockey that we see played now.
Okay. All right.
Well, Kerry, congratulations and good luck.
Thanks. Saturday at 11 is our first game against Richmond.
Okay, and that's in Chapel Hill.
Yes.
Okay, duly noted.
Right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
They're also good promoters, by the way, as well as being good athletes.
Yeah, the base of field hockey is in the Massachusetts area, but this area has become the heartbeat of college field hockey. And the Wake Forest coach, Wake Forest has won two straight national championships, said that the reason is, and the players confirm this, that because of the weather here, they can practice outdoors all the time. And the coaches use this as the recruiting leverage against the northern schools, which have to practice indoors.
So we might see a trend away from the northern schools being dominant in this in coming years?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know much about field hockey, but I do know that it's a lot has to do with I think it's personality driven. And you just happen to have dominant and subdominant field hockey coaches in the league right now. You got Jen Averill, who's done a great job at Winston-Salem, and you got Missy Maharg, Hall of Fame coach at Maryland, Karen Shelton at UNC, Beth Bozeman at Duke. And so they've gone and just recruited the top players to come out of the Northeast and out of the Midwest and play at their schools. And these field hockey teams also, when you start to study them, have an international flavor. You'll see players from Germany, the Netherlands, from England as well, where the sport is played. And I think it's a lot like ACC basketball right now. I mean, I think that this is a period of time. I mean, ACC fans should put their basketball brains on play record. I mean, just push the record button right now, because you got coaches at the absolute top of their game. Roy Williams, Mike Krzyzewski, Skip Prosser, Herb Sendek, Gary Williams. It's really remarkable, isn't it, Lennox, that we're living in a period of time where I think the history of the league right now is so rich because of these outstanding coaches at the tops of their games.
And I think the players have cycled to the point where the ACC has clearly the best talent now. And that'll run for a couple of years, and then there'll be a slight recession. And because the turnover is so rapid with players going pro early, you can never see too far out in the future. 3 years is a long time in college basketball. But right now, there's no question that the combination of players and coaches is at the pinnacle right here. And so this should be an outstanding season.
And one more thing about field hockey. We should explain that, Mick, you've sustained an injury that I see still underneath your left eye.
Yeah, I've tried to pass off some better stories about, you know, coming to a young co-ed's rescue in a bar when a guy was trying to hit on her. And let me see, what else did I have? Anyway, what really happened was not very glamorous at all, but I got hit with a field hockey ball in the head at the field hockey championships on Sunday. And we were getting ready to tape the open for the Fox broadcast, and this ball hit me in the head. And it's not very, you know, it's a tough thing. You get in touch with your masculinity. You know, you got an ice bag there on the side of your head when, you know, all these women are running around with injuries much more painful than the one you've got. So I just threw the ice bag away and just said, I'm just going to be proud of this black eye while it lasts.
Okay. We're talking with Mick Mixon from the Tar Heel Sports Network and Lennox Rawlings, who is sports columnist with the Winston-Salem Journal, talking about ACC basketball, but ACC sports, if you care to. Our number is 1-888-472-3366. Adam is on the line from Raleigh. Hi there, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call. I first want to start out with saying, Mick, I'm a huge fan, huge Tar Heel fan. Love listening to you. You do a great job.
Thanks, Adam. Appreciate it.
Not a problem. I wanted to say, first, you know, I agree with you guys in the fact that I'm going to miss a lot of these sub-rivalries, the way I like to look at it, because on the basketball side. Because when I first heard about the expansion, you know, being kicked around last year, I was right off the bat against it. Because as an ACC fan, I was always a basketball fan first, especially growing up in this area. But I've done some research, and I've looked into it, and I've read some report, I can't remember who and by what, but it said something about how John Swafford and the deal that he put together with the television and the BCS and the football and everything else after 10 years was going to be worth almost twice what the next conference, which was the Big 12, was going to bring into them. And I like I said, you know, if I have to take not seeing like a Clemson play Duke, I can't really remember how it's aligned, but you know, every team in the ACC is competitive at the other's home. It's rare that you see huge blowouts and just embarrassing games. I think the level of competition just across the board is better in the ACC than most other conferences can bring in and night out. I think you guys would agree because you see it on a firsthand basis every night during basketball season. But I really do agree with the fact that I think football is going to bring in way more money than any of the combined sports will, just on the sheer capacity of the stadiums, the news coverage that it gets through ESPN and all the other sports outlets that cover football. I think it was a good move on Swofford's part, and I agree that the ACC kind of lost some of its you know, white knight type status, or you know, that untouchable type status, because it did look, you know, we did kind of raid the Big East. But
well,
in my mind,
Adam, I'd like to put your question and your comments to Lennox Rawlings. With Lennox, what do you think?
Well, I believe that the competition is one element, and the business aspect of it's another element. And I think it was a legitimate argument as to how far universities should go to be entertainment businesses. And at this point, these universities have essentially said they should go all the way and do whatever it takes to make the money, that they're really businesses and teaching institutions secondarily to the business. And this is not just evident in athletics. I think it's evident throughout the universities and their relentless pursuit of money and grants and connections with federal sources or private sources of money. And so the nature of universities has changed over time. So I think it would be because, as Dean Smith said, basketball was the front porch of this university in Chapel Hill. He didn't intend for it to be that way, but it turned out that way. So on a broader scale, I don't think it's surprising that athletics becomes a front porch for these huge money machines that universities are now.
Mick Mixon, a moment ago in our conversation, you were saying that that the ACC, people might not come poaching here as long as the ACC kept the teams happy. But at some point, making them the teams happy, the athletic departments happy, could come at a price elsewhere in the university.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're already seeing that. I mean, I'm just thinking while I was listening to Lennox that, you know, at my house, the fundraisers that call me the most is the Fraternal Order of Police. Second to that is the university where I attended, and they call, and I can't keep it all straight. I mean, are you calling from the journalism school? Are you calling from the Educational Foundation, the Rams Club? Is it the Alumni Association? And so there's this push for money right now, and it is kind of unclear sometimes where's the money going. I mean, it's just staggering when you hear universities say, okay, we're going to go on a $3 billion fundraising campaign. And then, so I wonder, you know, what's that going? It seems to me like a lot of it's going to build things. I mean, you can buy a lot of textbooks and hire a lot of professors for $3 billion. But it is odd. I just think it is odd that the chemistry, you know, the Keenan professor of history makes, in some cases, one-tenth what a modern-day head footballer or basketball coach would make. You could also argue that the basketball and football coaches have tougher jobs. But it does seem to me as though the pyramid is kind of standing on its point right now.
Okay, Robert is in Greenville. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, that's kind of one of my concerns and comments is where do you draw the line? Because college sports in general, they're only one of the purest form of sports left. And I went to NC State, and I saw the RBC Center, and I see all the work going on at Carter-Finley. And I know that's why these expansions take place, is for more money. And that's my question is where do you draw the line, or can there be any guidelines put in place not to ruin such a tradition that we've built all these years?
Lennox?
Well, I don't see that there are going to be many lines left. If you see the expansion of the stadium at NC State, the surcharges that they're trying to leverage out of people to maintain their season tickets in the place they're in, all for a team that has a 4-5 record. I think there's going to be dissatisfaction within the university among the fan base to be hit for that kind of money and to have a lesser return. So When you have that, this is just a microcosm of what you see at a lot of schools that's happening at Carolina in football. When the teams don't produce, when these teams of 18 to 22-year-old athletes don't produce the desired result and stroke the egos of the people who gave the money, the people who gave the money are going to demand that something else happen. And in a lot of cases, what happens is the escalation of the building war, the arms race, as it's called, within the football industry, the escalation of the pressure for another football coach who will cost even more money. Everyone or most people are aware that now in the speculation, what would Carolina do if it changed football coaches? A name that keeps coming to the forefront is Steve Spurrier. Steve Spurrier would want $2 million a year. Is the University of North Carolina willing to pay someone $2 million a year to coach football? To me, it's really skewed when you look around. You can drive 30 minutes from here and find people who aren't eating properly. And to think that all of this fits into the normal framework of business, and you see all the people laid off in the Research Triangle in the last 5 years, I think it really becomes a perversion of what universities originally intended to be.
Yeah, and if you make $2 million a year, you make more than $6,000 a day. Whether you play golf or whether you go recruit, whether you win or whether you don't, that's money in your hand. That's a lot of coin. You got to work hard to spend $6,000 every day. The sociology of this thing to me is so interesting because, very, very briefly, most successful organizations with which I'm familiar, businesses, the dominance of the power structure is very clearly defined. You've got owner, president, CEO, chairman of the board, and you've got the middle-level managers. I mean, everybody knows the strata of that organization. But look at a modern-day Southeastern, a major Southeastern university, like, let's say, UNC, the school that I'm most familiar with. Who's the most powerful person at Carolina right now? Is it the chancellor? Is it the former head basketball coach, Dean Smith? Is it the board of trustees? Is it some big boosters? Is it the director of athletics? Or is it so spread out that it's really kind of gray? And different people have different types of power. And I think the danger is if major decisions need to be made, if policy needs to be refined, if kind of university legislation needs to be written, then who's going to do all that? And I think that's one of the – I think Lennox and I are basically saying the same thing, only in a different way, but I think it's one of the most interesting things. I mean, big universities now are some of the most complex, much more complex entities than even Fortune 500 companies.
Now, for fans, I wonder, might we see something that happened in Major League Baseball where it got so expensive and that you saw minor league ball happening? Will fans who might have been – who just might not – favor their teams anymore because of either the high prices or they're not performing, go to, you know, college teams that are in another league, a smaller league?
I've heard cases of that. And in fact, I know people who go not just in college athletics, but in other forms of sports, stock car racing, for instance, would go to a lower level to get a sense of what it used to be or what they see as the essence of that sport. And there will be some of that. But I think television and imagery drives the market because it captivates the imagination of young people. So as time evolves, those people want to see what the major league element is, no matter what part of entertainment or sports or life that you're talking about. They want to see the big time deal. And so as long as you have that brand identification, I think that's where the money will gravitate toward the brand.
And if you pay $2 million, like if I'm a newspaper and I can get Lennox Rawlings, then even though he comes at a hefty price tag, then that might be worth it. I mean, there might be a money-making – that's part of the problem, too, is that it might be a good deal. If you got a Steve Spurrier, it may not take you very long to make up that $2 million in ticket sales, concession, rights fees from your radio rights holder, et cetera.
1-888-472-3366 is our number. We are talking with Mick Mixon, who is with the Tar Heel Sports Network. He's a color analyst there. Lennox Rawlings is sports columnist with the Winston-Salem Journal. And Jamie is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I am primarily a basketball fan. That is my first love for the ACC.
Which team?
Duke.
Okay.
Grew up in North Carolina. And what I really, I've always hated the idea of the expansion. I don't like it. But what I really hate now is the new ACC logo. It's become a map of the eastern part of the United States. It used to be a great-looking logo, and you could identify it anywhere. In all the other conferences, you could see that, and they'd go, that's the ACC.
Well, Jimmy, this is Mick. Did you really like the old logo that much? I mean, if I came to your house, would I see this displayed on artwork or articles of clothing that you wear?
Yes. I do have it on T-shirts.
Wow. Well, the new logo, the ACC is a little sensitive about this because it's kind of it's egg-shaped, but they don't want you to call it egg-shaped. They say it's an oval.
I think it's an oval.
Oval, that's right. It's an oval logo.
An orb, right? Lennox, do you weigh in on the new logo?
I find it eternally fascinating that people identify with these icons of leagues and schools, and how someone's helmet looks or uniform looks. It becomes a major issue, especially if you go out in the parking lot and have something to eat before a game with some tailgaters. All of these things seem to matter, so I'm just more or less amused by it. But I think it'll be funny as time goes on, maybe. If this thing follows
its
logical extension would be, and I wrote a column about this, for the ACC to expand to Europe. And so we could have a logo with the ocean in at the center of it.
Jamie, would you put the logo of the ocean on your on a T-shirt?
Well, I wouldn't mind, you know. Hey, Europe, if we can claim its Atlantic coast at least.
Yes, we can. Thanks so much for your call, Jamie.
Thank you.
We're talking with Lennox Rawlings, sports columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Mick Mixon, who's a color analyst at the Tar Heels Sports Network. We're talking about ACC basketball. Give us a call, 1-888-472-3366. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pancava. We are revving up for basketball season with Lennox Rawlings, who's a sports columnist with the Winston-Salem Journal, and Mick Mixon, color analyst with the Tar Heel Sports Network. This, of course, is the first basketball season first ACC season in general, since the expansion of the ACC to 11 teams, and that's a topic of a lot of discussion still among fans. If you want to join us, our number is 1-888-472-3366. That's 1-888-472-3366. Well, the play is going to start in earnest within the week. But 5 months from now, there would be the ACC basketball tournament. That's one of the most anticipated events of spring here in North Carolina. There have been 50 of these ACC tournaments held in the history of the league. Only 7 of them have ever been outside of North Carolina. But with the expansion of the league, we're going to see more of those happening outside of North Carolina. Lennox Rawlings.
Yes, well, they've been scheduled for different sites through this decade. Going to Florida later on, Atlanta again, where they were a couple of years ago, and this year in Washington, D.C. I think in the long haul, the interesting concept, especially in terms of whether North Carolina retains a large percentage of them or enough to satisfy the people of North Carolina, the issue will become if you have 12 teams and 12 fan bases, 12 contributor bases, where can you put the tournament that there are enough seats to accommodate those numbers of people? And there really aren't many places to go, and Atlanta is a Southeastern Conference city and has a tradition of holding its tournament there and moves it around a little, but essentially that's the home base for them. There aren't any domes really within this area that we're talking about that fit the concept of what the ACC wants to do. So I'm curious, and I fully expect someone in North Carolina one day, perhaps not too far from now, to propose putting public money into building this kind of an arena, with the leverage being that if we want the ACC tournament in North Carolina, we're going to have to do this in the long run. So you'll see another raid on the Treasury at some point, I imagine, and if not North Carolina, in some other state, but I certainly expect to see it here in within 10 years.
Would you have any speculation as to where in North Carolina this would go?
Well, the fight is always there are 3 major metropolitan areas, and Charlotte certainly would want to be among the first. But since Charlotte's building its second arena in 16 years, I think they would have a hard time pulling it off there. So it seems logical, since the seat of government is in Raleigh, that the push would come from this part of the state and perhaps in the Greensboro area. But we'll see. I don't know anyone specifically involved in formulating this plan, but I just expect it to happen.
Do you think a couple of seasons of having the game, the championship outside of North Carolina, might fuel those fires?
And there'll be quite a number of those years coming up.
Right, because this coming year, it's going to be in Washington. Next year, it's in Charlotte, but then it's out of the state for 2 years after that.
It goes to Atlanta and Florida before the decade's over.
Yeah. Mick Mixon?
I don't know. It is what it is. It is where it is. I don't think there's much you can do. It's fair to move it around. The other schools in Maryland and some of the Florida schools now, they really get pretty ouchy about this thing if every ACC tournament is in North Carolina. But this is the geographic epicenter, and it's also kind of the dynamic hub of the ACC. If you look at Tobacco Road, and it's not North Carolina's fault that Wake, UNC, Duke, and NC State are all right here. So I think maybe half of them should be here and then move the other half around. I think the ACC tournament to me in Atlanta was well run. I mean, to me it went much more smoothly from a media standpoint, from a game administration standpoint. I climbed up to some of the seats I thought would be poor seats, and the sight lines were better than I thought. So I hate to admit it, but with their big building there, Atlanta does have a good venue, don't you think, Lennox?
The Atlanta Dome, the Olympics were there in 1996, is the first time I saw basketball there. And surprisingly good arena, considering that they split it in half and they had the gymnastics in the other half with this temporary divider. And it worked out well for both sports. And I think I agree with Mick that the ACC tournament there was a terrific tournament. And I think most people were satisfied with their seats. The fact that the SEC is there most of the time presents a logistical problem in retaining that building. But that is a terrific place. Mike Krzyzewski makes a point, perhaps because he's lost two national championship games, two large games in the Dome in Florida, that he doesn't believe in taking this to places where basketball is not the king, and I assume he meant Florida.
Okay. We should just – what's the geographic center of the league right now? Isn't it somewhere like Danville, Virginia or someplace? Just build the Georgia Dome in Danville. And let's just have it there every year.
We'll call it the Danville Dome.
Danville Dome. There you go.
Warren is in Raleigh. Hi there, Warren.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome to the show.
I used to be an NFL fan until money just got too crazy. So then I went to the college level to where I felt like, well, they were playing. It was fun. It was competitive. And now I've gone to high school level because those are the, it's not money driven. They're there because they really want to play football. Rashawn McCann's got in trouble with his statement, but the truth is, he told the truth. He's there to get to the next level. And it's just, I think it's sad that it's gotten to this point. I remember when my children played T-ball, the coach used to always say after every game, did you have fun and did you make your parents proud? Are those questions even asked anymore?
Mm-hmm. A buddy of mine called me up last spring, and he lives in Charlotte. He was all beside himself. And I said, Dan, what's wrong? He said, well, it's about my son, Scott. And I thought, my gosh, Scott has some neoplasm or there's some bad diagnosis. Where I said, well, what's wrong? And I held my breath, and he said, well, he's 0 for his last 9 in Little League. And I don't know what to do about it. Should I get him a coach, private hitting coach? Should I, work with him myself? I said, well, does Scott know that he's 0 for his last 9? Well, I don't know. I don't think so. He's just having fun playing ball. Then why can't he do that? I think, Warren makes a good point. You take, as a fan, that's your right. You take your loyalty, your support. Nobody's super gluing you to the stands. Go wherever you want to go.
Are there people, too, who are shifting their loyalties maybe from men's basketball to women's basketball? As this gets bigger, are we seeing any of that?
I haven't seen much evidence of that. But I do know people who make the point, who like women's basketball. They make the point that it's more like men's basketball was in the era in which they were young, passing the ball, trying to work off screens for jump shots, and played more at a pace and below the rim, more like basketball was 20 or 30 years ago. So I think there's some of that. But the thrill and the just tremendous athleticism of these players in the ACC is going to make you sit up and watch, no matter what, if you like basketball.
Okay, Scott is in Durham. Hi, Scott.
Hey,
Hi, did you have a question for our guests?
Oh, yes. About expansion, they say it's, I think it's pretty good. We're going across the whole country now, but I think we need to go across. What do y'all think about it?
How far?
Boston College is far enough.
Okay. Now, what is it you like about the expansion?
Well, the ACC was going to do it anyway. Why not do? The ACC was going to do it anyway. They were going to have to do it, or they were going to have. They were going to lose a lot of fans because basketball is seeing has to grow. So why not do it?
Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense to me. If you're going to do it. I mean, let's just say Scott's right. If you were going to do it, then why do you end up with Miami, Virginia Tech, and Boston College? I mean, just if you're just going to rewind the tape on this, and Scott started this, not us, but if you're going to go back to the summer of 03, why not try to get Kentucky? Why not try to get Florida? Why not try to get South Carolina? If you're going to raid a conference, you know, why not raid the SEC for schools that might be a better fit for what you're trying to do?
For basketball?
Well, I'm just talking about as an all-sports conference. I mean, I would argue that any two of those three schools that I just named would be better for the ACC overall than Boston College and Virginia Tech would be.
Lennox Rawlings?
Well, I think that Florida State, among the teams in the league, drove expansion. Mm-hmm. And the object outside the league was Miami primarily. So everything played off of that one card. And, of course, in the original scheme, Virginia Tech was not involved and Syracuse was. So, whereas Syracuse has a greater national tradition and has won a national basketball championship, I think Virginia Tech's a better fit. I just think it's a matter of scale that if you have a league in which everybody plays everyone, then you have a conference. If you have a league otherwise, then you have a corporation.
And I want to thank you both for being with us today. Lennox Rawlings, sports columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal, and Mick Mixon, color analyst for the Tar Heel Sports Network. Thanks both.
Thanks, Melinda. Enjoyed it.
Thank you both.
Well, as we've been talking about, the men's college basketball season starts for many teams this week. According to several preseason publications, the Wake Forest Demon Deacons enter the season as the number one team in the country. Dave DeWitt, our senior editor here on The State of Things, visited a Wake Forest practice recently and has the story of this often overlooked ACC team and its rather unique coach.
The Wake Forest University campus in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is a perfect postcard on this late fall afternoon. Fallen leaves stick to tree-lined paths as the sun sets over the towering brick chapel. It's a bucolic, hushed setting until you walk just a few yards away from the middle of campus and into the Miller Center, where the men's basketball team is holding a preseason practice. In this small practice gym with cinder block walls, head coach Skip Prosser holds court. The action is intense during the intra-squad scrimmage until a whistle blows after sophomore Kyle Visser misses a defensive assignment. Skip Prosser is not your average coach. While he is intense and fiery and sometimes slips into motivational rhetoric, he also begins each practice with a quiet team meeting devoted to non-basketball topics. He's a voracious reader and peppers his press conferences with words that send sports writers scurrying for dictionaries. His players, like shooting guard Justin Gray, don't get off easy either.
He does the same thing to us, using words. When he uses, you'd be like, hold on, let me jot that down, make sure I know what that means, because sometimes he says stuff in practice. I have no idea what he's talking about, but you better shake your head like you know, or he's going to yell at you. But, I mean, he's just one of the better coaches in the league, and not only in the ACC, but in the nation.
Skip Prosser's players describe him with words like honest, tough, and funny. It's a style that has served him well for over 30 years, beginning with his first coaching job at Lindsley Institute in Wheeling, West Virginia. He began his career, as he says, wanting to be something else entirely.
I mean, I wanted to teach high school history. And going to the Merchant Marine Academy, I didn't take any education classes. I mean, they at the Merchant Marine Academy taught you how to drive ships, you know, across the ocean. I loved teaching. I was really looking forward to teaching the history, and I thought I'd do it forever. But I was at a private school that was in dire need of coaches. Basically, they said, we'll give you the teaching job, but you have to coach ninth grade basketball and help out with ninth grade football. And that was my introduction to coaching.
Skip Prosser coached in high school for 13 years, slowly moving up the ladder until he led Wheeling Central Catholic to a state AA championship in 1982. But it was a motivational tactic Prosser employed the year before that Doug Wojcik, who played point guard at Wheeling Central Catholic and is now the associate head coach at Michigan State University, remembers.
We had played earlier in the year downstate, down in Huntington, West Virginia, and that's near Charleston, West Virginia. Charleston's the state capital, and Charleston's where the state tournament was held. And on that trip, he took us to the Charleston Coliseum, Charleston Civic Center, and it was vacant, and took us in there and just said, we're going to get here someday.
Skip Prosser made the jump to college coaching when he was hired as an assistant coach at Xavier University in Cincinnati in 1985, getting the job only after three others turned it down. He would eventually become the head coach at Xavier, and then, in 2001, he arrived at Wake Forest. Athletic director Ron Wellman hired him.
He really understood Wake Forest University and the type of institution that we are. He supported what the university stands for and was going to recruit within those parameters. He was going to recruit outstanding players, but great people as well, people who were truly student athletes. And just his enthusiasm for his profession and coaching and being around young people.
Wake Forest is often overshadowed in the Atlantic Coast Conference by its powerhouse neighbors Duke and North Carolina, and coaches Mike Krzyzewski and Roy Williams. But what some see as Wake Forest's weaknesses, its small size and out-of-the-way location, are considered strengths. Again, Ron Wellman.
10% of our students at Wake Forest are student athletes. So our athletes are essentially in every class on campus. There are very few professors who do not have the opportunity of teaching student athletes at Wake Forest. And that in itself is very unusual on a college campus, and it's just a reflection of the size of our university.
With the number one preseason ranking comes high expectations, a rare situation for both Wake Forest and Skip Prosser. The school has not reached the Final Four of the NCAA tournament since 1962, and Prosser has never led a team past the Sweet 16. If Wake Forest does make it to the Final Four, it will be the culmination of a 30-year coaching career, and for Skip Prosser, a long way from teaching ninth grade history.
That was State of Things senior editor Dave DeWitt reporting on the basketball program at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem. Wake Forest opens its season this coming Monday night against George Washington University. And for today, that's the State of Things. If you have a comment about our program, our email address is sot@wunc.org. That's sot@wunc.org. And at our website, you can also hear archived editions of the program. The State of Things is directed by Keith Weston, edited by Dave DeWitt, and produced by Corey Princel and Stephanie Hirsch. Robin Copley is our technical director. Susan Davis is the senior producer, and the executive producer is Fred Wasser. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava.